you're listening to The Coffee Hour, I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
Thanks to Concordia University Wisconsin for your support of The Coffee Hour. You can find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
We get to talk music today. We get a little music appreciation right now, which is very exciting. It is a popular season for requiems, which is a difficult word to say today, but... Today we get to talk about Mozart's Requiem and requiems in general, how we understand them as Lutherans. So joining us today is the Reverend Brian Hamer, U.S. Navy chaplain, and he also writes the monthly column, Lifted Voice for Around the Word Theology for the Curious Christian at whatdoesthismean.org, where I believe you've written about requiems before, haven't you, Brian?
Yes, good morning, Andy and Sarah. Good to be with you and our listeners today. And one sort of sub-column I have at Lifted Voice is called Rescuing the Requiem. So from time to time, we do focus on the Requiem.
Perfect.
Can you say that three times fast? Rescuing the Requiem.
I can't. Not at least in public. So Chaplain Hamer, let's start off with just a very basic understanding. What is a Requiem?
So the Requiem is the medieval communion service for those who have died in the faith. The word Requiem means rest. And just like, say, for this past All Saints Day, there are certain propers that we follow, an appointed introit and gradual and lessons and so forth. The introit for the medieval mass for the dead starts with the word Requiem. Rest eternal, grant them, O Lord, and may perpetual light shine on them. Through the years, composers have, of course, been inspired by these propers. So just like if you go to hear, say, Mozart's Mass in C major or C minor, those are really five excerpts from the broader Mass or communion service. The Lord have mercy, the glory be to God on high, and so forth. If you go to hear a Requiem, you're hearing the parts of the service that have inspired composers through the years, inevitably starting with the word Requiem, rest.
So Requiem means rest.
Makes sense.
Okay.
It's appropriate.
I'm on board with that. So how does this concept of Requiem align with what we believe, teach, and confess as Lutherans? Are there challenges, I guess? Is that a fair word to ask?
Yeah.
Oh, there are many points of discussion that you can take to your pastor, to your church position, to the Lutheran's Lady Lounge and put on something from Sock Religious and have a very good conversation. As you look over the Requiem, you start, of course, with the introit, which we already covered, rest eternal, grant them, O Lord. The next part is the Kyrie, which we all know. Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. There, we're good, right? A common text throughout the scripture. Some of us heard it from blind Bartimaeus in Mark 10 just a couple Sundays ago. The next part is a sequence hymn. Sequence simply means you can sing it in two or more stanzas with the same music, in a very lengthy sequence hymn that's based on Zephaniah chapter 1, where Zephaniah talks about the day of wrath and the day of mourning. If I could permit me just a little more Latin here, this is the Dies Irae, and this is a particular focus for Mozart. So you'll hear the day of wrath and the day of mourning in a very apocalyptic image of the final judgment on the unbelievers, followed by the Rex Tremenda, the King of Majesty, and then the talk of tears and of lamentation. There is a Lutheran parallel to the Dies Irae. And Sarah, do you remember the Lutheran hymnal hymn 607, Day of Wrath, Day of Mourning?
Oh, yeah.
You do? Andy, I don't know if you've sung that one or not. But against the Lutheran hymnal, 1941, hymn 607. Unbelievably, it has 19 stanzas, which has to be some type of a record for congregational singing. My parish in New York was a page 15 parish, and they were established in 1915. So I always like to say page 15 since 1915. And here we are in 2024, they're still using the page 15 service. And that they sang this, get this, they sang it on the day that I was installed. And the day that I left, they sang songs of thankfulness and praise. I don't know if there's a direct connection there or not. But this is 18 stanzas of law, okay, starting with Day of Wrath, Day of Mourning. See fulfilled the prophet's warning, and that's from Zephaniah 1, heaven and earth in ashes burning. Is there any false doctrine there so far? Absolutely not. It's simply describing the implosion of this world as God ushers in the new creation. So you have 18 stanzas based on the medieval hymn, and then finally, we let you off the hook in stanza 19, if anybody is still singing and has the voice. To the rest thou didst prepare me. On thy cross, O Christ, upbear me. Spare, O God, in mercy, spare me. In brief, a Lutheran view of the Requiem is this. With this Dies Irae at the center and getting most of the attention in text and in music, it's going to be awfully heavy on the law and just a little bit of token gospel. So you always want to listen with discernment.
Yes, yes. Can we, let's talk more about how we understand each of these parts of the Requiem, which ones we can listen to and be like, yes, this is exactly what I, what agrees with my Lutheran understanding. And maybe some of these parts are, we can listen with some discernment of the different parts of the Requiem.
Absolutely. I already mentioned that the Kyrie is part of the Requiem because it is part of the Mass. So we're good, right? If you walk into your Lutheran church musician's studio, you might see some Requiems on the shelf and you might think, oh no, you have a Roman Catholic church musician. No, you simply pull out the Kyrie and you can sing that perhaps during distribution or perhaps as a choral Kyrie. The other text that everybody's going to recognize, and I know you're getting ready for the Mozart performance of this Saturday and Sunday, is the Sanctus, the Holy, Holy, Holy from Isaiah 6. So the easy thing to do, and this is what I do in my subcolumn, Rescuing the Requiem at Lifted Voice, is I simply focus on the Kyrie and the Sanctus. The second thing to know as a Lutheran is just that balance between law and gospel. As I'm looking over this Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath text here in TLH 607, and even the medieval text that I have in another document in front of me, I must confess, I don't see any false doctrine. It's just awfully heavy on the law. It tends to be a little bit light on the gospel. One little fun thing you can throw in, and please talk to your pastor. You ready for this? Now, I know this is being broadcast at high command at the International Center, so I'm going to tread very carefully by quoting somebody else. The Apology of the Augsburg Confession, Article 24, Paragraph or Section 94. Regarding the adversaries quoting the Fathers about offerings for the dead, we know that the ancients speak of prayer for the dead, which we do not ban. Melanchthon said it, not me. Ancient prayers for the dead, which we do not ban. So when you go to a Lutheran funeral in the rite of Christian burial, listen carefully. Are we not at least offering a benediction that God would continue to fulfill his blessed promise of everlasting life for the deceased and or for us? And I should probably leave it there. The other thing you can take to the Mozart this weekend is this. You know the transcendent values, truth, beauty, and goodness. That's a link between good choral music in the concert hall and what we believe in the Lutheran Church. Truth, beauty, and goodness. You are going to hear astounding beauty in this Requiem. You will certainly hear plenty and experience plenty of goodness. Think of the way people react. I once sat down at a Fort Wayne Philharmonic concert as a seminary student, and the seminary student next to me, as we sat down preparing for the concert, said, you know, Brian, there's more reverence here than in some churches. And I said, yes, absolutely there is, because there's something happening there that's true of goodness. And then, of course, you're also going to hear plenty of truth within that Requiem, and also some things that you will, of course, disagree with that make a good theological conversation next week.
So why are they particularly, why are Requiems popular, particularly in concert halls and other places this time of year?
From the perspective of the concert hall, Andy, if you're planning a season, you of course have Christmas, right? So here comes the hip parade in the concert hall. And then you look ahead to the Easter season, and that's when you'd probably plan maybe a St. Matthew Passion or a St. John Passion. And then as you try to fit things in between and maybe coordinate them with other events, even the concert hall, I think, is aware of All Saints Day. So you might hear it this time of year. And then they might squeeze it in, say, in February between Christmas and Easter. So yes, even the concert hall as echoes of the church year.
Absolutely. I want to go back to what you were talking about with truth and and beauty. What do you love about pieces like the Requiem? And Mozart's isn't the only Requiem. What do you love about pieces like this that we're able to connect our Lutheran doctrine and our beliefs and some things that we hear in church to things that we also get to hear out in the world in the concert hall?
Yes, the truth, beauty, and goodness, it just reminds me that there is, I don't know if you've seen the book by Jeremy Begbie that is called The Theological Promise of the Arts, and how truth, beauty, and goodness, which are really the intellectual property of the church, actually are present in the concert hall, certainly in Bach and also in Mozart. If I could offer a few recommendations for listening, there are up to, cannot begin to count how many works we have that are called Requiem. What you're going to hear from Mozart this weekend is, of course, the Latin text. Some have gone to German text, English text, and even hybrid text. And please see the book by Alec Robertson, Requiem, Music of Mourning and Consolation, if you want a pretty comprehensive view up into Benjamin Britten, 1962. But my playlist recommendation is this. For beauty, go with the Mozart Requiem, which comes from the classical era. For truth, listen to Brahms, a German Requiem, which does not use the Latin text at all. He simply uses Bible verses from Martin Luther's German Bible. And you will all recognize the fourth movement, How Lovely is Thy Dwelling, O Lord. For goodness, fast forward to the 20th century, the early 20th century, and listen to the Requiem by Herbert Howells, Howells. That's a very short Requiem that has psalm verses and a little bit of the Latin text and the beatific vision from the end of the book of Revelation. So again, Mozart for beauty, Brahms for truth, and Herbert Howells for goodness, and you will not be disappointed.
Those are some really great recommendations. I'm going to go listen to those right now on my own playlist. Chaplain Brian Hamer, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about Requiems.
Always a pleasure.
And coming up next, we get to talk with one of the artists that's actually performing with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra with the Mozart Requiem. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon, whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan. You'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Oh, this wooden toy set is really, really fun.
It is.
We could pretend it's like real life.
Kids love to play, and play that points to Jesus is a big part of a child's faith journey. Wooden toys from Wicking Vicar do just that, growing the faith through play. Wicking Vicar's Children's Church playset lets little ones delve into the divine service, and the Children's Advent Wreath is a safe way for kids to make the Advent tradition their own. Solid wood and heirloom quality for children ages 3 and up. Order yours today at wickingvicar.com and click on Wooden Toys in the menu bar. This Christmas, gift the children in your life faith-building wooden toys from Wicking Vicar.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
Right now joining us is Kelly O'Connor, mezzo soprano, talking about the upcoming performance of Mozart's Requiem happening with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra in just a few days on November 9th and 10th. It's not September anymore. November 9th happening with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So this is really exciting, being able to talk with another musician. We love talking about music and about really great musical performances on The Coffee Hour. So it's so exciting to talk with you about the performance of the Requiem coming up very soon. Let's talk about what it's like to be a professional vocalist. Tell us about your journey to becoming a professional vocalist.
Well, it's a pretty good vocation, I do have to say. When it's good, it's really good. And, you know, I have always been a musician. I started in choir in elementary school and was always really, always singing in choirs, mostly throughout high school. College, you know, I thought, well, this is what I do, so I guess I'm going to college for it. Still couldn't kind of decide if I was going to be a soloist. I really, really enjoy making music in a group. And that's why I love doing concert performances as much, so much with symphonies, because I really feel like I'm part of the collective. And it's a much more enjoyable experience for me than being by myself. So I was very fortunate. And I was doing all the auditions at the end of my college run and auditioned for Tanglewood. And they were doing a modern opera. And the composer picked me out of, you know, who knows how many. And he said, I like her low voice and she looks like the character that I want her to play. So it worked out. And at the time he said I had, you know, one eyebrow. So he liked that. That was not true, but we're going to go with that. So I was fortunate enough to be part of this opera by Osvaldo Golioff. And I played the role of Federico Garcia Lorca, a pants role. And we performed it all over the world. It got me my agent. Everything kind of stemmed from that one moment. So I always say to people, audition for everything because you never know when the chance is going to come. And that was so true for me. And then I just kind of took off doing a lot of new music, actually, at the beginning, which is not normally the traditional route for people. But I thoroughly enjoy doing new music.
Now, for our listeners who maybe don't spend a lot of time at the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra or enjoying wonderful music like this, when you say new music, mm-hmm. Can you clarify that? Maybe define that a little bit more for us.
Okay. Well, first, I like to say that I do the living guys. So, you know, It's become much more popular. There's so much more new music out there nowadays and being performed even at major venues everywhere. People are really into it right now. So works like by John Adams, Osvaldo Golioff, Thomas Addis is also another very popular modern composer. And these are the living guys. And it's kind of a fun adventure because you're really, really creating and you're part of the process of making the piece, which we don't get to do with, as I call them, the dead guys, you know, Mahler, Mozart, if you will, Brahms, you know, you kind of, it's written down on the page and it's already created. So your interpretation, of course, affects that, but you have much more a part in new works, kind of molding how the piece will go. And it's a very fulfilling thing to do.
So from that span of dead guys to living guys and gals, what have been some of your favorite performances?
Well, I do have to say, John Adams wrote me a big part in his gospel called The Gospel According to the Other Mary, based on Mary Magdalene, and I was Mary Magdalene. And we did it with a Los Angeles Philharmonic all over the world. Stage performance, it was a huge part of my life for a decade, and including me shaving my head because the director wanted me to. So it was really an all-encompassing thing, and it was so worth it. It was so good. So that was really a highlight. And then especially for me, when I've performed works by Gustav Mahler, I say he's my main man, and he loved also a mezzo-soprano voice or an alto voice. The low feminine voice was really something he was drawn to. So I've had the pleasure of doing this monumental piece called Das Lied von der Erde, which is kind of like his ninth symphony. And I did that in St. Louis with Stéphane Deneuve, and it was a big highlight of my life. So that was also another really, really fulfilling experience. It's nice to come to the classical kind of known works after you've done the newer stuff because, you know, I'm thinking, hey, I can do this. I'm justifying myself. So it feels good to kind of achieve myself as well in that realm. It's just such a different thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You've mentioned a wide range of composers and composing styles. I've sung a lot of those in bits and pieces. I mean, not nearly on the performance level as you, but like the Golioff is amazing. Mm-hmm. Very different. Mahler is just immense. So like this broad spectrum of composers and works. Do you have some favorite composers, or is that like picking a favorite child?
No. I mean, Mahler, definitely.
Okay. Yes.
You know, I mean, Mahler, because I get the best parts. Sometimes, you know, Das Lied is a very heavy load for the mezzo. It's very hard. The last song she sings is 30 minutes, and it's a farewell, and it's very dramatically and vocally challenging. But there are some pieces, Mahler's Second Symphony, for example, or Mahler's Third Symphony, where I sing maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and I get to just sit in the best seat in the house, as I call it, right by the conductor, and I just feel the symphony going on around me, and it's the best. So I will take any Mahler anytime. That's what I definitely say. And I just performed my first Verdi Requiem, speaking of Requiems, and that is also an incredible piece. I think there's something about Requiems and composers that they just find this inspiration that's outside of themselves. I think you can definitely sense that in the Mozart. To me, it's very apparent that he was inspired, and it really was a collaboration for me. Yeah.
All right. You mentioned the Mozart. So let's talk about the Mozart Requiem happening November 9th and 10th with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. What makes this Requiem, Mozart's Requiem, unique?
I've had the great blessing to do this piece so many times. It's extremely popular. You know, audiences really respond to it. Choruses love singing it, and conductors love conducting it. So it's widely done all the time. And, you know, as many people know, this was probably, yes, the last piece that Mozart wrote before he passed away, and he didn't even finish it. So I recently learned that, you know, he was kind of living hand to mouth for a long time, even though you don't think of that with Mozart, because he wrote so much music. I mean, it's just like, come on, guy, just like can't stop. There's so much. He was such a genius, but he really knew how to spend the money as well. So he was a big liver of life. Do you know what I mean? And he just was not, he just couldn't keep up with his spending. So this last piece, Constanza, his widow, you know, she needed it to be finished because she needed the money. So she kind of found some of his pupils to help finish the project. And I think it's really, there are many pieces that are kind of unfinished. And most of the time people leave them alone. And, you know, you don't really have somebody else. But I really feel like Zusmeier, who is the pupil who finished the composition and orchestration of this, really did justice to it. I mean, he could have fooled me, as I would say. You know, it's so beautiful. And I just feel like it really is also a deeper, more reflective side of Mozart that we don't always get. He's a very humorous composer. He's one of the few that I think really exposed all sides of himself. And, you know, he wasn't always down in the dumps. He really lived life and he was joyful. So I think this is a very profound piece for someone like him.
I'm trying to remember now. This is going, I'm showing how old I am, but the film, the Amadeus film.
Yes.
It closes with this piece, right? Doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And I think this is some anniversary of it. I am not going to age myself and say when that came out, but it is, I think it is, you know, and that's a dramatized, you know, again,
right,
I think
sure.
Mozart, I mean, he did have some sort of annoying laugh. I think that is true. But but it was a little much. You know, I love that guy mm-hmm. in that movie. But, you know, I think also with the movie, they say that Salieri finished it, but that's not yeah. true, you know, and that Salieri poisoned him. And I don't think that's true either. I know. It was a heated rivalry. You know, Mozart was kind of the chosen guy. I mean, you see why. It was like almost everything that he composed was just gold. I mean, it's insane what he was able to put out. So, and I love nowadays, you know, they're doing the movies in concert. And so you can actually go see Amadeus with the live music, which I think would be cool.
I'll have to add that one to the list. I have seen a few film with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. And yes, yeah. It's changed our family. We've decided we can never watch film without seeing it.
I know.
The whole score played by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra.
That's okay. If it's going to get you in the hall, we'll take it.
What do you love about singing this Requiem, Mozart's Requiem?
Again, I'm a choir girl at heart. So for me, you know, just any choral pieces really always resonate with me. And I just think that, you know, it also hearing a group of voices together really affects an audience. I feel more such than just a solo voice. So to me, it's a real pleasure to just be part of that. And the alto has some good leadoff lines, like the Benedictus is pretty good. I really love singing that, you know, and it's just so incredible. I remember several times I've done it with a bass that, again, was in choir, and he mouthed all the words. He knew all the words, the entire thing, you know, and it's just because you can't help yourself. It's just this really visceral reaction I think that people have to it. You know, it's kind of the perfect Requiem. Don't quote me on that, but now we might. Because it's also concise. It's not like I feel like there's not a wasted note in there. You know, it's not as if you're going to think, okay, is this going to stop at some point here? You know, I feel like it's just really, I mean, that does happen. So, you know, I just feel like it's very close to perfection. You know, and all of the melodies are so individual and rememberable. And that's, it's, it, Mozart was good at it too. And you can really tell in this piece. Yeah.
My husband is one of those basses that mouths all the words to all of the music that we ever go see anywhere. So I get that. Yeah. Now, you mentioned Mozart's skill of using the music. How do you see him using the music to really express what the text is?
Again, I feel that, you know, when we're examples like the Benedictus, which is, you know, a benediction, a kind of a grace moment, I truly feel that I am like a prophet kind of giving these people grace. It really, it gives me grace to sing it. It's as if he knew just how to write the vocal line so you feel at ease and you can deliver that. Also, that happens for the quartet in the Tuba Mirum, which is kind of the day. It's kind of a little bit of a daunting, scary thing. And it starts with the, you know, the trombone doing this big thing. And then the bass comes in just like really, you know, he was so great at melodies and vocal writing, as we know. So many operas, just very successful writing beautiful arias. And that's what he does in this piece. And to me, the Lacrimosa, which the Lacrimosa was the last thing he wrote. The first eight measures were the last thing he wrote. And it's just, you can feel the breath leaving your body. I don't know how he did it, but to me, it's just, it's it captures a moment in time. So I just, you know, it's just, it's really such a complete work.
What are you looking forward to most with like 30 seconds left?
Okay. Well, I have done this piece many times, but I've never done it with Stefan Deneff. So this is, I'm very excited to hear his interpretation. He's a very detailed, very passionate and artistic conductor, and he always has great ideas. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what he does with it.
Yeah, his interpretations of things are always very special. So yes, that
completely.
Is spot on. Where can we learn more about you and the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra?
Okay, I have a website. It's kellyoconnor.com. And you can also visit the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra website at slso.org. And we hope to see you on November 9th and 10th.
Fantastic. We'll put those links in our show notes today. Kelly O'Connor, mezzo-soprano, thanks so much for joining us today on The Coffee Hour.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.